the Film Detail interview with Ambrose Herron.
Okay, Stuart Cooper is the director of Overlord, which is out in limited release at the ICA Cinema in London, and gets a proper DVD release from Metrodome on 3rd of March. Stuart, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
Okay, just tell us a little bit about Overlord. It's a film about a soldier in his training up to the D-Day landing. Overlord was the code name for the D-Day landings. Tell us how you got involved in the project.
Short story, it's a long story, but I'll make it a short story for you. I was originally asked to make a documentary about the Overlord embroidery, which was commissioned by Lord Dovelton. It was being more or less monitored by the Imperial War Museum. And one of the trustees, a man called James Quinn, who was the actual producer of Overlord, had seen a picture, a documentary I had made a couple of years beforehand called The Test of Violence. And The Test of Violence was a documentary about the Spanish artist Juan Genoves, or Genoves. And it depicted his very graphic paintings. And what I'd done with that movie is to kind of recreate and dramatize the paintings and bring them to life with live action and with newsreel footage. And when I was approached, that was kind of what they wanted to do with the Overlord embroidery, which is kind of the contemporary version of the biotapestry. So part of my homework for that, I agreed to do the picture. Excuse me. So part of my homework was to go into the Imperial War Museum, into their archive, and begin research using the World War II archive as a device to bring the tapestry to life. It was, here's the short part. This is where the path less traveled becomes important. I got into the archive and I started doing research, and as I was doing research, I began to realize, because the archive opened up this unbelievable world to me of footage, which a lot of stuff hadn't been seen, had only been used badly before, had never been used in outside of a kind of a documentary sense. And as I began the research, I began to think there was an opportunity to make a bigger, and in my opinion, more important picture than the documentary about the tapestry, a real full-on World War II piece, using the archive in a way that hadn't been used before, to underpin a dramatic story and really to wrap a dramatic story, give it the broad picture, if you like, and intercut with it a dramatized story. And as this, I spent over 3,000 hours in a dark room viewing footage. There's 39 million feet of it up there, which would take you, if you did it on a daily basis. I tell a funny story, I won't do it here, but if you actually did it 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and worked your way through the entire collection, daily it would take you probably 9 years to view it all. That's how much footage was there. All on nitrate footage, because everything up to the end of the war was all shot on nitrate. They started shooting on acetate, sort of 45, 46. So that's how I got into Overlord. That's how this creation started. Alongside of doing the research in the film archive, I also exposed myself to the document sections, and of course there's a dearth of material. I mean, it's as much as there is film footage, and I had met a writer called Christopher Hudson, who's a journalist, still a writer here in London, and I asked him to come on board with me and co-write the screenplay, and I needed to let him loosen the document section, because we drew upon a lot of absolutely incredibly, really vital and visual, unpublished diaries and letters of ordinary soldiers who had seen D-Day, you know, seen the first wave, second wave, D-Day 1, D-Day 2. And we drew, in the end, we drew a lot on diaries and letters for certain scenes in Overlord, which give it an authenticity which, you know, you have probably not seen in other war films. And the thing that we really discovered was kind of interesting about the Overlord experience, because it is a movie which is interwoven with archive. I say archive as opposed to newsreel, because newsreel is newsreel, yeah. And archive is a slightly different thing. It's all the same footage, but I'll explain it in a second. We discovered that until we decided what the archive would support in a narrative film, we couldn't just go off and write a screenplay. You know, we couldn't go off and write, you know, say Sergeant Ryan.
Yeah.
And then expect the archive to suddenly be where we wanted it to be. We really had to establish what the archive would uphold in a dramatized story. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of tailored our dramatic story to kind of merge in, almost like a tapestry, you know, almost like an embroidery. You know, it's kind of a weird connection, but to interweave our dramatic story.
But that is the real astonishing thing about the film, is how you managed to do that, because, you know, some films do use archive footage, but this is really quite ambitious in the weaving of so much archive footage. And
yes.
How did you go about getting the archive footage you wanted? Because, like you say, there was so much. Did you ask the people at the Imperial War Museum that you wanted bits from certain times, or did you give them a broad outline? How did that work?
Well, in my stupidity to begin with, I actually thought I could look at the whole collection, which is why I told that little piece, and I was told very quickly by Anne Fleming, who was the curator of the keeper of the film at the time, that it would take me 9 years if I wanted to see the entire collection, whereupon I was sent back to the card catalog. In the old days, they had a fairly cumbersome and extremely large 5x8 card catalog system, with everything was more or less cataloged, like old libraries.
Right.
And those card catalogs also lead you to dope sheets. What was interesting is as opposed to the newsreel footage or the compilation films that were made of the period, the real archive is comprised of raw footage shot by the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. Hundreds of cameramen all over the country, at any battle scene, wherever they could be, shooting raw footage. That is actually the heart of the archive. Later, that footage would be drawn upon by filmmakers and documentary filmmakers and propaganda filmmakers and put into compilation films and what have you. What I really did is I kind of did broad strokes, and I decided I kind of wanted to start the film around Dunkirk. Mm-hmm. I knew I was heading for D-Day. I knew I had kind of main points, would probably be the best way to explain it, that I thought we needed to cover in our story.
Right.
I had devised in my head early on that I wanted to tell a simple story, because I felt that anything too complex would just fight with the archive. Mm-hmm. And in my conversations with Chris, we decided to tell a simple story. And the thing that I brought to it, conceptually, I suppose, right up front and early on, and I kind of sold it to the producer, was a story in which the main character begins to have a premonition of his own death, which is a main theme through the movie. I didn't really dream that up. I found that in the letters and diaries I read of ordinary soldiers. Many of them wrote about, they had a sort of presentiment that they wouldn't get through, or they would get wounded. Many of the diaries were like that. They expressed a feeling of what was in front of them, and their chances of getting through were poor. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what triggered the idea of a story with a premonition. Yeah. And what happens in the movie when you watch it is that actually the premonition is shown up front.
Yeah.
And then we meet these men in a landing craft, which we meet at the end of the movie, before the onslaught to D-Day. And that premonition could have been any of those soldiers. However, in this case, that premonition finds itself to Tom, who was our main character. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, I had these kind of pointers.
Yeah.
And I just started looking at footage. You know, I'd look at 25 or 30 reels a day. I'd sit in this little room and just watch film, make notes, stacks of notes. I had pages. I can't tell you how many notes I had. And I kind of hit targets. I did, you know, home front, fires of London, Dunkirk. I looked at all the German footage. I ended up by looking at a big section of the archive, primarily from Dunkirk to D-Day.
Yeah.
Would be my window.
Yeah.
In there, and I was being led all the time by the archive. The archive was kind of feeding me where I would take the screenplay, and I'd pass all this on to Chris. Chris looked at a little bit of archive, but he was stuck in documents, pulling scenes, and we just started to put this collage together. Mm-hmm. You know, but again, the simplicity of my narrative story was the key to the balance between the archive.
Yeah, it's almost like watching the film, you've got the vastness of the archive footage, the vastness of World War II, contrasted with this simple but quite effective tale.
Right. There's a very important line which Chris wrote, which I think was absolutely brilliant, where Tom is writing his letter home to his father, or to his parents, his mother and dad, and he says, we feel like we're part of a machine, which gets bigger and bigger
as
we get smaller and smaller until there's nothing left. And that's kind of what the dynamics of the movie are, and that's the dynamics of the archive. The archive really, in a sense, gives you the in a totally authentic way, which is why people are surprised by Overlord. It gives you the big picture, you know, and then he's just a little cog in the machine. He's just part of it, like so many other men.
Yeah.
It's not a heroic movie. It was designed specifically not to be a heroic movie.
Yeah.
Tom's demise at the end is as bleak as it can be. I designed it that way because there's nothing heroic about being shot on the beach or in the landing craft. He never gets out of the landing craft, which we also discovered there are many casualties on D-Day of men who actually didn't get out of the landing craft.
That's right.
And while Tom has imagined, in his premonition, has imagined his own demise and kind of seen himself hit the beach, and we do a little bit of that. We recreate a little of that. It's quite dramatized. It's quite dramatic, you know, in full film, you know, Peckinpah sensibility, you know. But that's his imagination. That's his mind's eye, what he sees. And when it actually happens, it's awfully bleak, and I think it shocks a lot of people at the end.
Yeah, the other thing about the D-Day footage is, what I hadn't ever seen before, the footage from Overlord, is all these contraptions the Allies had. Like that Catherine wheel thing.
Yes.
Now,
the great pen.
This was like a wheel that would come off the landing boats and would be fired by rockets, like a Catherine wheel. And the idea was that, I guess, it would hit the German barracks and explode.
Yes.
And sometimes it didn't. It just,
most of the time it didn't.
But it looks like something that has been made up, but it hasn't. That's real footage.
You know, there were so many, and Churchill was very smart. I mean, he designed some of this stuff, like the mulberries. There's all kinds of, you know, and the thrasher that would come on and thrash away at the all the barbed wire and stuff and clear mines, and then the carpet layer would come behind it to make a path for the soldiers. But the Ferris wheel that you're talking about, it didn't work. No. The concept behind it was it would probably scare the hell out of the Germans.
Yeah, they'd think, what's going on?
What the hell is this? Yeah. It would roll up the beach, you know, scare, set off a few mines and everything. Mm. But the problem with it was that it constantly turned around, came back as, you know, at its own soldiers.
Yeah,
which it was doing there. In fact, it was losing its coming back. Great shot, though.
Yeah, it does look extraordinary. Yeah. And some of the other footage from the film, I mean, in the commentary for the DVD, I actually make this point. It's kind of a curious contradiction. The bombing of Germany, the lighting from the bombs, it looks incredible, but at the same time, you then cut to the, you know, charred corpses. So it's kind of an odd thing. I mean, what pilots must have seen, or the guys filming this stuff, was extraordinary in all senses of the word, wasn't it?
Yes. I remember Anne Fleming saying to me when we got it, that material is called the ops material. It's all Bomber Command. A lot of wonderful, it was interesting about reading the dope sheets, is you could see what crews got through and which crews didn't get through. And oftentimes crews, you know, you'd pick up and remember a name, and then you'd see that crew is no longer there because there's so many casualties. But I remember Anne Fleming saying to me, when you get into the ops material, you'll be quite amazed at how beautiful it is, how sort of stunning it is. And it really truly is. Mm. And I remember looking at all the raw footage on it and making a lot of notes and being just, I thought, my God, it's just extraordinary. There's no special effects in Overlord with the exception of at the end, the reflection in the eye.
Yeah.
It's the only optical in the entire movie.
Right.
And people, I think, are amazed that there's no, you know, digital effects there or no CGI work.
Yeah,
it's the real deal.
It's well ahead of its time.
And it is. It's a kind of light show. Mm. And in that bombing run, you see the flares being put down first, you know, the bombing run to set the targets, and then you start to see it. And actually, if you look carefully in the clouds and all those explosions that are going off, you can actually see the Lancasters moving through the clouds at night. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. Very beautiful, scary. And I think it just felt natural to me to cross-cut and go to the ground and see cause and effect. Yeah. Basically, it's cause and effect. Mm. And I just felt I was obliged to do that, you know, to make... I wasn't trying to be a smart filmmaker and say, now you... You know, I just thought... I felt it was an important issue that I had to show both sides of the picture.
Totally.
And then, of course, the final shot of that particular section is that very long floating tracking shot that I think it was Essen, which is just a bomb site.
Yeah.
I mean, the city's just completely decimated. There's nothing there at all. It's a little bit like the shot of Corfe Castle at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And that's why Corfe Castle's there, to remind us about war upon war upon war upon war.
What was the... when Overlord came out, it got released here, but in America, do you think it was just maybe the wrong time? 75 was when America was pulling out of Vietnam.
Right.
Maybe didn't want to see a film like this. Was that part of the reason it didn't?
I think that's part of it. I think there's a lot of things. We tried so hard to get it. We had a good run with Overlord in Europe. Mm-hmm. We won all kinds of awards. We won Berlin. The Special Jury Prize in Berlin. It also got the International Evangelical Award for its homage to the Unknown Soldier. It had some nice prizes. And distribution wise, it was always an art house movie, but it got exposure, TV sales around Europe, and it had pretty good legs. Mm. As hard as we tried, we couldn't crack the U.S. We tried in this, when the film was finished, the late 70s, I tried again in the early 80s, and nobody wanted to touch it. The only person who would show it, and actually showed all my esoteric British work, and wondered why, he was a man called Jerry Harvey, who ran the Z Channel. Mm-hmm. And there was recently a documentary made by Zan Cassavetes called The Z Channel, A Magnificent Obsession, which I think Metrodome, I think they put it out.
Right. Yeah.
I can come to that at the end of the piece.
Was this a station in
L.A.?
L.A., right.
It was a movie station.
Right.
Run by a man called Jerry Harvey, who's no longer with us. I won't go into his details. He was a great programmer. Mm. And he discovered Overlord by mistake. It was shown to him by an agent of mine in Los Angeles. I was still living in London at the time. And he called me in the middle of the night and he said, I know every director on earth. He says, how come I don't know you? How come you're living in London? Why are you an expatriate American? He's a real powerhouse. And he said, what else have you made? This whole thing. Anyway, long story short, I sent him everything. He wants to see all my documentaries, all my features, of which there were three, all made with the same photographer, Johnny Alcott. And he said, I want you to come over to L.A. And we're going to spend a month running your movies, one-on-one with all the critics. Then I'm putting them on the Z Channel. They'll be on there for a month. It actually got me a huge job out of this.
Right, brilliant.
And the Z Channel was like the forerunner to the HBO. It was the first cable station, and it was a brilliant station.
Right.
And so that's the only exposure that Overlord ever had.
Right.
To answer your question, backtrack. Vietnam, absolutely. I think it had a huge effect.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's interested in seeing a war film.
Yeah.
The climate had changed so dramatically politically. It was a black and white picture.
Mm-hmm.
It had archive footage in it, which made it kind of documentary.
Yeah.
At a time where documentary films were just not even,
Michael
Moore hadn't come on the scene yet. Documentaries were just not.
Documentaries were seen as TV in those days, really, weren't they?
Yeah, and like Victory at Sea and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But even that was kind of 50s and 60s, documentary world was gone. In U.S. films and television, it's been refired up again.
Yeah.
It didn't enjoy the kind of sensibility the documentaries have always had, the BBC and all that. So I think the fact they had documentary footage, and the other thing, of course, it was a very British story.
Yeah.
So I think we had four strikes against us before we started.
Yeah.
And it never happened.
It's weird because sometimes films about the D-Day landings, like Longest Day and even Saving Private Ryan, they get a lot of flack for not having enough about the British, but is he doing a British story?
Yeah.
It's funny, you can't win.
We got the flip.
But you mentioned John Alcott there, one of the legends of cinematography. Shot Clockwork Orange,
Barry Lyndon,
which he won the Oscar for,
Shining.
I pity the guy who worked on The Shining with the Steadicam and Stanley Kubrick doing take after take after take, but a great cinematographer, and of course his work in this is brilliant. Tell us about working with him, how you hooked up with him.
Johnny was my mentor, probably my closest friend, and my father's my oldest son's godfather, and he passed very young. He had a heart attack and can drop dead. He was about 52 years old. Without question, he was a world class photographer. And you could count world-class photographers at the time, probably today as well, on two hands. You put him there with Storaro and Gordon Willis and Sven Nykvist and some of the great photographers. I met Johnny when I was getting ready to prepare a film called Little Malcolm and His Struggle Against the Eunuchs, based on David Halliwell's mid-60s cult play that Johnny Hurt did.
And Ewan McGregor was in that about four or five years ago.
Was it a film or a stage?
A stage play in North London.
That's right. I read it on the stage, Well, this, we made it, the film was produced by George Harrison. It was the last picture that was made by the Beatles before Apple closed down and the big divorce started over Klein and all.
Yeah.
You know, all the Beatles had had a film gig and George hadn't had one.
Yeah.
John had done Imagine, Paul had done Magical Mystery Tour, and Ringo had done something with Harry Nilsson, Frankenstein or Dracula or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Something like that. Dear old Harry Nilsson. God, I'm surprised I can even remember this stuff. And George wanted to make, he'd seen Little Malcolm, he loved John Hurt, and he wanted to make that into a movie. And we shot the whole film up in Oldham. And it won the Berlin Film Festival the year before Overlord. It won the Atlanta Film Festival. It had very little exposure, only on Z-Channel again, thanks to Jerry Harvey.
Yeah.
All things go back to the same place.
Yeah.
And I met John. I'd seen Clockwork. Mm-hmm. I knew his name. He came to my cutting rooms. I loved him. He was terrific. He came in with some clips. He was working with some new lenses that were phenomenal, and he brought some stuff. He'd read the screenplay, and we got on like a house on fire. So he shot Little Malcolm, came on to Overlord, and then he shot The Disappearance. So basically what's going on, he did the big pictures with Stanley, mm-hmm. who I got to know quite well. Then he comes in and makes some little movies. So we're basically rocking and rolling for about 7 years. That's how it went, because he did Clockwork, Little Malcolm, and I think Barry Lyndon, or maybe Overlord was before Barry Lyndon.
75, so he would have been around.
Right there, Barry Lyndon. Then he did Disappearance and The Shining, or the other way around. But that's how it went. So everything we did looked different. That's because John had, he was a real inventor in direct relationship to Overlord. Several important things happened. First of all, in an unprecedented move, the Imperial War Museum gave me access to the original nitrate negatives. Mm-hmm. They hadn't done that before. Usually if you were drawing into the archive or drawing upon it, mm-hmm. you get a Duke negative or a fine grain or some intermediate piece of film or sock. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it let me go back to the original nitrate negatives to make my own Duke neg. The quality of the original nitrate negatives was just pristine. So once Alcott saw what good quality we could draw out of the archive, we then started to work. We started to devise a way that we could match the archive. Mm-hmm. John decided that we should shoot the whole film on old lenses. And we managed to find, we scoured Europe, and we found two complete sets of 1936, 1938 Goetsch and Schneider lenses, uncoated. And we shot the whole picture on old lenses. Kodak mucked in and gave us the old black and white stock that they had. And Johnny used a lighting style that was totally reminiscent of the 40s. And I kept the set with the camera work, really what I call flat on. Mm-hmm. Again, reminiscent, kind of mirroring 40 films. Nothing fancy, just kept it simple.
Yeah.
And it helped us to get there. And then we did a lot of work in the labs with interpositives and stuff to actually match it even more.
Right.
So that was a, you know, that was a huge effort to, you know, to get this seamlessness between the two types of film.
Yeah, it really pays off because the look is all of one. Even though you can see it's archived, the look and the lighting is really quite.
We're really on. I think it really worked. Yeah. A lot of editing to get it. Even though I had I had my notes and I knew what footage I was pulling from the archive, I had a wonderful editor, Jonathan Geely, also who's no longer with us. But we had about 750,000 feet of archive in the cutting room. Mm-hmm. And even though we had a broad stroke idea, we still had a lot of fine-tuning.
Yeah.
And I remember the funniest thing, the first screening we had of the film was at Berlin. Alcott, I was in the cutting room for about 7 months with this thing. Mm-hmm. Alcott hadn't seen a foot of it after we just finished shooting, the live-action story. Mm-hmm. So, but he came to the Berlin Festival with me, and we're sitting side by side. It's the first screen in Berlin, huge theater, hundreds of people. The picture looked wonderful. And about, I don't know, 20 minutes into the show, John leans over and he says, "Did we shoot that?" He couldn't even remember.
Right, right.
You know? And he's looking at the picture and he's saying, you know, we did lots of little pieces and stuff, you know, just to, like a jigsaw puzzle, you know, just to make things blend well and to make transitions work. And he said, "I can't remember what's ours and what's this, you know." So that's a nice comment.
Is that good? Just finally to sum up, I mean... I mean, this is really quite a unique film, and it's great that people are going to rediscover it now. I mean, what do you think it says about the times now? Obviously, wars still go on, probably going to go on till the end of time. But, I mean, do you think there's something timely about the re-release of it now?
I do. I think, and I could talk a little bit, it may be a good way to answer your question. I can talk a lot about how the picture was recently received in the U.S. particularly.
Right.
And I think it's probably similar. It'll be a similar experience in the U.K., but... we finally had a really great release through Janus. We opened in Washington at the AFI. We opened in New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, all the major cities. Reviews were phenomenal. A.O. Scott, New York Times, fabulous. Roger Ebert, fabulous. He actually reviewed it twice. And I did a lot of Q&As and travel with the film to about 8 or 9 different festivals during that year. Overlord seems to have touched a nerve, you know, in 2007.
Yeah,
when all this happened. A lot of interesting questions during the Q&A, and it's clear to me that because of the political situation of the U.S. today, in particular Iraq, that Overlord, they connect the dots, and Overlord speaks to them, even though it's about World War II, it speaks to them about what's currently happening in their lives and what they're experiencing in the news and on television 24/7.
Yeah.
And all wars are different politically. I mean, World War II happened because of certain politics.
Yeah.
Iraq is going on because of certain politics. But I think what happened with viewers in America is they realize that the business of war never changes. And they see something in Overlord, that the business of war never changed. The politics change, but the business of war never changes. And I think that's the frustration. It's an old story. It's not a new story. It's a very old story. But I think they connect the dots and they say, here we are again.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I hope people go revisit it. It's out on DVD March 3rd. Stuart, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a download from filmdetail.com. To find out more, go to filmdetail.com/podcast.